Today is October 15, 2019, and on behalf of SABRE, the Society of American Baseball Research, we are interviewing Mr. Vernon Law for our oral history project. My name is Steve Jaremko, and I'm talking on the phone with Mr. Law, who is at his home in Provo, Utah. By way of introduction, Mr. Law was one of the outstanding right-handed baseball pitchers of the 1950s and 60s. He played in the big leagues for 16 years, all of them with the Pittsburgh Pirates, from 1950, 51, and 54 to 67. He retired as one of the franchise's winningest pitchers. Vernon Law peaked at the right time in 1960 as he led the Pirates to the National League pennant with a 29 record, 20 wins and 9 losses, a league-leading 18 complete games, and a career-high 122 strikeouts. He was a two-time All-Star in 1960. In the 1960 World Series, Pittsburgh faced the high-powered New York Yankees led by Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris, Whitey Ford, and Yogi Berra. Mr. Law won games 1 and 4 and started the rollicking Game 7, which ended with Bill Mazeroski's legendary walk-off home run in the bottom of the ninth. Law was named the 1960 Cy Young Award winner and the 1960 National League's the Sporting News Pitcher of the Year. Though he had success in years thereafter, injuries impacted Vernon Law's career and reduced his effectiveness. Mr. Law made a stunning comeback by winning 29 games in 1965 and 66. He was named the 1965 National League Comeback Player of the Year. He finished his career following the 1967 season with 162 wins and 147 loss record, 1,092 strikeouts, 119 complete games, 28 shutouts, and a 3.77 career ERA. He won 10 or more games 9 times during his 16-year career and topped 100 strikeout mark 3 times. As a member of the Church of the Latter-day Saints, Mr. Law served as a lay minister during his entire career. His exemplary life has served as a role model for both young and old. We are very honored to talk about his life and career. Welcome, Vernon Law, to the SABRE Oral History Project. Okay, welcome. So I'd like to start off with, what was your given name at birth?
Well, my given name is Vernon Law. Vernon Sanders Law. My mother, that's the middle name, but it was Sanders. My dad's wife was her last name, Sanders, and so Vernon Sanders Law was my given name.
Where and when were you born?
I was born in Meridian, Idaho, a little farm community back then. Dairy, there were a lot of ranchers at that time. I wasn't born on the ranch. I was in town at the time when, and my dad worked for a garage that he was a good mechanic, and so that was his line of work, and so that's where I was born. But shortly thereafter, we moved out about 6 miles out of town into a farm country, and I was actually born and raised on the farm, so I know what work is. at the age of 6, I was milking cows, so it was a tough life, but that's where I learned how to work.
Well, let me ask, your father, you said he was a mechanic. Was he an auto mechanic, or did he work on farm equipment, or?
Well, both. Motors, he was very good with motors and automobiles. Matter of fact, I remember one time when we was hunting up in the mountains, we had snow, we broke an axle, and he said, if you ever break an axle, look on the right side, because that's where it usually is, and sure enough, that's exactly what happened. So, anyway, he was a good mechanic, and I worked mostly on my automobiles, but then when war broke out in 1941, we moved to California, and there he worked on a submarine base on submarines. So he knew a lot about motors and so forth, and so, you know, that's that was his job during the war. And then when that was called off, why then we moved back to the town of Meridian again.
Oh, okay. Now, was that skills that you also picked up, the mechanical skill?
I didn't pick up, I was busy. going to school, by the time that I knew anything about automobiles, and then when I signed a baseball contract out of high school, I never did get the opportunity to learn an awful lot about motors, but just enough to, know what the problem is when there is an automobile that breaks down.
Oh, that's great. What was the name of your father and mother?
My father's name was Jesse Law. My mother's name was Melva Christina Law.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so there's I might add in there too that my dad lost his first wife she had given birth to twins, and then about 3 months later the twins died with pneumonia. They call it consumption back then. And then about a month or two after that, he lost his wife with the same thing.
Oh, my gosh.
And so, yeah, and by that time, he had 7 children. And so when he married my mother, why, there were 7 children that she had to take care of. That was not a very good situation for my mom, because the youngest daughter was the oldest daughter was about 3 years, maybe 4 years younger than my mother.
Wow.
And so you can see that there was not an easy life for my mom, having to raise girls that were just, younger than she was, and so... I don't think they wanted to be bossed around.
I guess not.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, anyway, that was kind of the situation.
Your parents are both incredible people. My gosh.
They had to be. They had to be back then, that's for sure. But we had that 80-acre ranch, and everybody had a job. I can remember working all day long in the hayfield that team of horses pulling a wagon full of hay and taking it and get it to a stack where we unloaded the hay. And so, we had a neighbor that had a bigger ranch than we did, and I worked for him also. And I can remember putting in a good full day's work for $1 a day, and these were silver dollars back then, and so... Anyway, when we got through, I had $7 in my pocket, 7 days and $1 a day. I got $7 a day, and I didn't know what to do with it because, living on a farm, living out in the country, there was really nothing for me to. So I just give my dad $7. That's kind of how life was on the farm. You just worked, and I know my dad promised me that when I grew up, about 14, 15, why, he would give me a calf to raise, and so, anyway, that's what he did as payment for us, so, but it was, that's back when, you could go to a movie for a dime, you could buy a loaf of bread for about 15 cents, and gasoline was about $15, well, 15 cents a gallon. Those are days that a lot of people don't even know about, but believe me, life was not easy. This is because I was born during the Depression, and so it was really a tough life early on, but then gradually things got better for us.
Well, that sounds like you grew up poor. I mean, you guys were, your family was a hardworking family and really didn't have too much extra money. Did you have other siblings beside the seven that, that came into your dad's marriage?
Well, yes. I had two brothers. I had two brothers, Evan. Matter of fact, I gave him a lot of credit for getting me to the big leagues because he was my catcher, and we really worked well together. We played all the sports together. He and I was very close. We did everything together, played all the sports. We hunt and fish together. It was a good life, We ride horses out in the desert and shoot rabbits and one thing or another, So we'd usually go swimming in a canal. It was a lot of fun during those years too. So we just didn't have to work every day, and work hard all the day. Even though if we did work, we'd get on a horse and ride to the canal and go swimming. So that's the way life was back then for us. But it was hard. It was hard from our parents. I really didn't know anything better than that, I didn't know life could be much easier. I thought that's just the way life was. And so, fortunately for me, I had enough talent that I was able to sign a professional contract. And even back then, I spent 2 years in the minor leagues. I can remember my paychecks were maybe $250 a month, and that was it, And then when I got to the big leagues, our base salary was $5,000, and I took that, as a lot of money, more than I'd ever seen, and even my parents are the same way. We didn't have $5,000 a year when we had the farm, and so anyway, it was difficult, a rookie did it when I got to big leagues, it was $5,000. And today, the rookie today, his first year, is $555,000.
Isn't that something?
I didn't make one third of that in 20 years that I was with the Pirate organization. So you can see how it has changed over the years.
Indeed.
I still love the game. It's wonderful that, I watch the games, whenever I can, I watched the one last night where the Nationals, all they got to do is win one more game and they're in the World Series.
I know, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, they haven't been there since 31, I heard, 1931.
Yeah, it's incredible. It really is. They're in a great position, in all reality, I don't know who's going to win the other, but I hope that for them, I think would be great. It's great to have baseball, in other cities in the World Series, and that's so. I'm kind of rooting for the Nationals right now.
Oh, I'm with you.
Yeah. So anyway,
it's
life is good. You enjoy it. It's when you're having fun, and even today, I look back on those things, and it's a lot of fond memories, a lot of great people that I've been associated with, and so forth, and it is a wonderful wonderful life if you can, and I do give my wife credit too, because she, without her, I don't think my career would have been as successful, because you just never know, I didn't have to worry about my family because she was such a good mother and a good wife to be able to take care of them when I wasn't home. Because, as you well know, the ball player, they spend half of their time away from home playing those games, in other cities. And if you don't have the support at home, it would have been much more difficult for me.
That's what one of my questions was going to be. I know you married a lady named Vanita, and all your children have names beginning with V, and you have six children, if I'm not mistaken, five boys and one girl.
Right.
And I was going to ask, how did you manage during the times when you had to travel so often?
It was difficult. It surely was. But we would travel together to spring training, and then when we moved north, that was it. She was on her own. Back then they considered the family excess baggage. that's the way it was. They didn't take care of the family back then like they do now. It's much easier for the ball player. And I guess the owners finally figured out, if the ball player is happy, he will play better. He'll feel more secure,
sure.
And so on. And that's truly the case but thank goodness, I had a wife that she would take the kids, would pack them up and drive to Pittsburgh. By that time, I might be able to find a home that we could live in for the summer. And then before the summer, the baseball season was over, she would get in the car again, drive all the way back to Idaho with the kids, and make sure they got in school and got settled, And so it was a tough life for her, more so than for me.
Oh, she's quite a lady.
Of all that.
Yeah, she's quite a lady. So anyway, getting back to your young years, did you play? By the way, you mentioned Evan. Is he still alive?
No, I lost him about 10 years ago. We had, matter of fact, I'm the only one in my family that's still alive. I lost all my family before they were 70 years of age, and I have to say that it was mostly because heart attacks.
Oh,
every
boy.
One of them died with heart attacks. And fortunately for me, my activity was such that my heart developed other vessels because I had a 7 bypass here, it was after our 50th reunion. Back in Pittsburgh. It was after that because I remember our one of our camp directors died right on the field playing golf, and I was about that time I was getting a dull ache in my wrist, and so I had that checked out, and I got on the treadmill, and I was on there for about 3 minutes. And the lady that I knew who was giving me the test, she said, "Get off, I've seen enough." And so she, when I got off, she says, "You got problems." And I said, "I do." And I said, she says, "Yes, we've been go over and see a cardiologist." Well, I didn't know what a cardiologist was, but she says, "I work for one right across the street." I says, "Good, I'll walk over and see him." And, "Oh, no, you won't. No, you won't. You call your wife, I'm going to come pick you up." And I said, "I'm fine." She said, "No, you're not." Anyway, she argued with me, but I got done. They took me over there, and sure enough, they gave me an electrocardiogram, and it showed that I had some problems. And so he said, "Let's go over to the hospital and have one of those angioplasty exams." Which I did, and they could see what the problem was, and the doctor there says, "When do you want to take care of this?" And I said, "Well, I don't care, whenever." And he says, "How about tomorrow morning?"
Wow.
I said, "Well, okay, if that's the way it is." And so, yeah, but after the surgery was done, he says, "If you hadn't been active, you'd have been dead a long time ago, because you were being so active, your heart did develop other vessels to kind of take care of the problem for you. And that's the reason I'm still around today, because of activity." So, I guess don't let the rocking chair get you when you get old, because that's what's going to happen. But fortunately, things have turned out. I still have great health and able to do everything. Here I'm quite close, getting very close to 90. And I do all my outside work and work in the garden, killing that, and taking care of that. So mowing the lawn and getting the leaves out of my gutters and so forth. So it's good to stay active and able to do that. So
I saw a video of you on YouTube, and you were pitching batting practice here just recently.
It's been 2 years ago. I stopped throwing 2 years ago.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't because that I wasn't able to. It was because my grandson and my son, who played professional ball also, I no longer had to throw batting practice. So anyway, that's the way it worked out. But anyway.
Well, I am so glad to hear that you got that problem taken care of early enough. And thank God you are active enough that you were able to survive and be so fit all these years.
Well, that's true. I'm telling you, that's great. I've enjoyed my life because I've been able to do those kinds of things, and that's very important, especially in your later years.
Well, getting back to when you were a youngster, did you play sandlot ball? Did you play American Legion or played in high school?
I did, yes. I played American Legion ball in high school. Our team in Meridian, we for 1 year we had a backer that could back it and help us. It was tough going because, we didn't have a lot of good equipment or anything like that to play, and everybody used probably only one, or we probably only have one or two bats that we had to use. But then the next year, we didn't have enough guys to play, or maybe a lot of it was because we didn't have the money, to have a team. But I, along with two of my teammates, we went to Boise and played for the Boise team, we had one that turned out to be that we had one of the 12 best teams in the United States.
Was that what they called a town team in those days?
Pardon me?
Did they call those town teams? Was that what they called a town team?
We did have a town team also. Yeah, but this American Legion team was. I think it was post what they call post 48, and that was in Boise. Our team was good enough that we won our championship, won the state championship. We went to the region. We won the region championship, and then we went to Billings, Montana for the sectional. It was a sectional tournament at that point. And it was there that I met Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth had just had a throat operation, couldn't really talk, he could whisper, but he was there making an appearance, it was there that I met Babe Ruth and got a signed baseball from him.
Wow.
But we lost out, we lost the championship there for the section, but anyway, it was, like I said, we had one of the 12 best teams, and that was pretty good for a little town that started out and then end up, being in that kind of a tournament was a lot of fun.
Well, there was could you describe how what led up to the signing by the Pirates at that time? Or did you go to college before then?
I had no idea what was going on, to be right honest with you. And I didn't find this out until after the Pirates had moved, not the Pirates, but after the Giants and also the Dodgers had moved out to the West Coast. And the real truth came out there because Bing Crosby was very instrumental in my signing. He had bought an interest in the Pirates, and so as it turned out, but I didn't know back then they didn't have a recruiting, they didn't recruit, they didn't have a program, where it was well laid out, and so what happened was that there was an attorney in Payette, Idaho, that saw me pitch, and he was a good friend of Bing Crosby's. And so it just so happened that in that tournament game down there, I, 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 well, they, there was scores nothing going into the last inning, and I can't remember the sequence. We scored a run. My brother Edwin either hit a double, and I got a base hit to drive him in, or I hit the double and he drove me in. But we had a 1-0 lead, and so now that they're in Fayette, they're the home team. And so anyway, I turn around, and there's a midget up there at home plate. Up there to get a base on balls, you know, and so my brother come out to me and says, "What are we going to do?" And I said, "Well, he's a member of the team. I'm going to have to throw to him." And so I tell you what, get on your knees, put the glove, because I've always thrown to a target. I said, put your glove right down on your knee, kneel on the ground, put your glove right down there, and by the time the ball comes over home plate, it's got to be a strike. Jeez. And so I threw three straight strikes and took them out. And so that impressed the senator of Idaho. He was a time practicing lawyer, later became the senator. But anyway, he called Bing Crosby, and Bing called the front office and said, "You better send a scout out to pitch out to Meridian, Idaho, and maybe he'd work for you to try and take a look at him. But I think he'd fit well in with the Pirates." And so anyway, that's what happened. And when I come home,
if I can stop you.
Because they couldn't talk to me, they couldn't talk to my parents until this whole thing was settled, you know, because it was against the rules to talk to a young man while he was still in high school.
Oh.
Well, okay, I come home and there's nine, well, there's, I don't know what was going on, but anyway, I get there and we've got several cars parked around my home there, and there was nine different organizations there. Ooh. How they found out about this, I have no idea.
Wow! Anyway, so they were all there at the same. They were there at the same time.
Yeah, they all were there. They were all there at the same time. But there was a whole bunch of them that when they come in the house to talk to my parents about me signing. Well, every one of them had a big cigar, smoking a cigar. And when my dad, he says, "I'm sorry, but we don't allow tobacco in the house. You're welcome to come in, but please leave that outside." And so they didn't make too good of an impression. But now the Pirates are the last ones to come in. And so when they come in, why, it's a dozen roses and a box of chocolates from my mother.
Wow.
Halfway through the conversation, the phone rings, and other on the end of the line is Bing Crosby. He was talking to my mother. And I'm telling you, my mother was a great fan of Bing Crosby's, and
boy,
I'm sure she was really flustered.
So that really anyway, sealed the deal then?
Yeah, well, it really did, but then I say this, too. I give Bing Crosby a lot of credit, too, for my signing with the Pirates, because what he did, he said, told my mother, "Tell your son, do not sign for a bonus." Now, if I signed for a bonus, it would have to be over $5,000. That's all. You know, and so don't let him sign for $5,000. You know, and so because he needs to go out and learn how to pitch. And indeed, I did. I didn't even have a windup. Matter of fact, my first manager says, "Do you throw a changeup?" And I says, "What's that?" I had no idea what a changeup was. You know, all I knew, I could throw hard, and I could throw strikes, and I could throw a curveball. I knew kind of, and so that was, you know, I'm just a dumb, country boy. I didn't know anything about pitching or anything. I didn't know how to set up a hitter, you know, and of course, I know now how important it is to throw a first pitch strike, get ahead, so you've got the advantage. When you get two strikes, make them chase a bad ball. I didn't know that. You know, I'd throw it down the middle of the plate because, you know, that all I had to do was throw strikes and get themselves out.
Yeah.
In some cases, that was true, but
not
when you're playing up there in the big leagues. That doesn't happen. But anyway, that's how I got signed with the Pittsburgh Pirates. But I didn't know the real truth of this. That back then, when I was supposed to pitch in Los Angeles, Bing Crosby was there with, and he'd come down and say hello to everybody. And I was supposed to be pitching this day, and I do my thing outside and come in, get ready to go out and warm up. And Bing Crosby and I, we visited for a little while, and he says, "You remember when you signed?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And he says, "Well, I want to tell you something you probably don't know. The Pirates went out and bought the box of cigars and passed them around to the other scouts so they wouldn't make too good of an impression."
A setup.
Because I only spent, well, of course, the season had already started, and so the minor league teams was already playing, and so I signed and I went down to Santa Rosa, California, which would have been a rookie league, and pitched well there. And so the next year I'm in Davenport, Iowa, and so in Davenport I had a major league pitcher that was my manager, and his name was Bill Burwell.
Oh, yes, yeah.
He
was a coach for the Pirates.
He taught me how to throw a changeup and also how to set up a hitter, you know, and make the hitter chase the bad ball and so forth. You know, Bill Burwell, I owe him a lot as well because of what he did to help me get in that position, because he told me, says, in batting practice, take a little bit off your ball and see what happens. Don't throw it as hard, but just throw a strike, you know. And so I did that, but then he told me how to hold it and so on, and that really made a difference. So then the next year I go to New Orleans, which is Double A, and I was there until about the time they had to cut down their roster. I was there about 2 months. I got off to a good start, and so they called me up. So I spent just about 2 years in the minor leagues, just opposite of what some guys know. And I'll tell you about Harmon Killebrew.
Oh yeah, he was from Payette.
Yeah,
and I think Senator Welker.
Yeah, go ahead.
I said I think Senator Welker also helped him as well.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And so in his situation, he did sign for a big bonus. And so he spent 2 years on the bench because he had to stay on the major league roster. And he stayed there and probably got in a few games, you know, blowouts and one thing and another, but not really getting a lot of experience. So when those 2 years was over, they sent him out. And he spent 3 years getting back to the big league. So that's 5 years, you know,
right,
in between. Well, I was there 2 years,
right,
because of the advice that I got, you know, and so that was important to me. I Harmon got a lot more money than I did.
Well,
that's okay. You know, sometimes money isn't everything, and being there in the big leagues was a goal of mine, and then that was what I was more interested in than money, because I've never had money in my life anyway.
Well, that bonus baby rule seemed to hurt a few players at that time. I know, you know, a few of them did okay. Al Kaline and, you know, Harmon, at once he got squared away, but it hurt a lot of players too, like you said.
Right. Yeah, it's exactly right, you know, and so, you know, I was one of the lucky ones, you know, that was good enough to hang around with the same team my whole career, which none of us wanted to be traded when it was with the Pirates. You know, we wanted to stay as a team, and because of that, I think that's the reason we got into the World Series in 1960, because everybody hung together and learned together and rooted for each other. We liked each other, you know. But I think part of the problems today with baseball is there's so many different cultures on a team that there's no real unity and no togetherness as we had. And I think that's important, you know.
Yeah.
It may be not important to some teams, but it really was important for us, you know, to be able to work together. And we knew each other well. We were pulled for each other and was really happy, you know, for the success because that year, everybody on the team had a good year. everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so that that really made the difference, you know. And I point to some of the trades that we make with getting the right people there on our team to that fit in. Don Hoke was one. Of course, Smokey Burgess came to us from Cincinnati. Hoke comes from to us from the Dodgers and had experience and knows what it took to win. And you know, even some of the guys that didn't play regularly, it was very important to our team, such as Dick Schofield. You know, when Dick broke his wrist, got his wrist broken before the season ended in 1960, why, Schofield stepped in there and hit over 300 and just picked up right where Dick left off, you know, and really kept us going. So that was very important to have guys that knew their role. I give Danny credit, Danny, our manager, Murtaugh, I give him credit for a lot of our success because he knew each player. He's had him for 3 or 4 years, knew each player, knew what he could do, and he'd put them in situations where they wouldn't fail.
You know?
And so that was very important on our team as well. So there's a lot of issues that we have to deal with that were solved. And so, anyway, it makes a real, real difference when you got good people, you know, you got people that like each other, get along, good group for each other, then you have a manager who knows how to handle his men and so forth. And Danny was a player's manager, there's no question about that, you know, and so. But it's interesting how things happened back then, you know, and how everything worked out in our favor. We certainly got a bunch of breaks during the 60 World Series because they definitely had a better team. There's no question about that. They had the talent. You know, they had guys who can run and hit. They had great arms. That had Whitey Ford as the chairman of the board. They had, you know, they had good. They had everything. Guys could hit home runs and so forth. Madeline Maris and Barrett, those guys, Smooth Scouring, you could name them, you know, everyone on their lineup could hit home runs if you laid it in there for them. So it was a different team. But, you know, when I go to New York, I'm interviewed a lot of times about the 60 team and how come we won the series when the Yankees scored so many more runs than we did. And I'd say, well, I would have to say that it wasn't the guys that lost the series. It was the manager, Casey Stengel, because he had Whitey Ford in the bullpen in the seventh game, in the seventh inning of the World Series, and he brought in, he brought in a different reliever. If he brought in Whitey, things would have probably changed.
He brought in
against Whitey Ford. So
Bobby Shantz did really good.
That's the guy that I blame. The manager.
Yeah. Well, Bobby Shantz did really good in that game, and then they brought in Jim Coates, and he didn't do so well. And Bill Stafford, he didn't do so hot. And then Ralph Terry gave up.
Right. You got it right. Yeah. It was Stafford and then Terry after that. Yeah, Shantz held us down. You know, he pitched very well. He held us down until actually Grote hit a double play ball to the shortstop. The ball bounced up and hit Kubek in the throat.
Yeah.
That took him out of the game.
Well, that changed the whole complexion of the game, I think.
It did because it was a double play ball that would have ended the inning in our rally because we scored 5 runs at that inning after Stafford got in there. There was a swing and bunt by Dick Stewart, Roberto Clemente, mm-hmm. that dribbled down first baseline. Well, Stafford chased the ball and Moose Garn was coming in. Nobody covered first.
Oh, yeah.
Roberto beat it out for an infield hit, you know. Mm-hmm. Somebody. Stafford should have been there covering the bag, but no, he didn't. And so that kept the rally going. So we got a couple breaks. So you never know, you know, what happens after that.
Well, I wanted to ask you, how did you feel at the time when you were pulled out of the game? I think Roy Face came in to came in relief of you.
Yeah, he relieved me and threw up a three-run homer.
Yeah, but how were you feeling at that time? Yeah. Like
well,
when
you know that was tough. You know, then you had to because up to that point, Roy had pitched well. You know, and then when they brought him in, what happened is Kubik got a walk off from me. I had counted 3-2, and I threw what I thought was a strike, but the umber called ball 4, and so he got on base. And but just prior to that, Hector Lopez got a base hit off from me in the right field, and so that put him on. And then when I walked Kubik, well, then Murtaugh made the change, and so, but I've worked out of trouble before, you know.
Oh,
and,
sure.
But you know, they had some good hitters coming up, and so he thought it was time to make a change, and maybe he saw something that I didn't know because of adrenaline. I didn't know that I had retore my liver cuff. I had torn it once before in 1951 in cold weather, and I found out that that this was the same kind of a feeling. I didn't feel it at the time, but I felt like I was still throwing good, and so but he made the change. Maybe he saw something that I didn't know, and actually it was right, because when I was driving home, I reached up, grabbed the steering wheel, and it hit me right in the back of my shoulder, and I knew then what it was. So I did tear my rotator cuff during that series, and it's all because of guys messing around when I got my foot, right foot, the one I push off a mound with. One of the guys grabbed it when they were celebrating, and I was the only one in our bus going home from Milwaukee that had all their clothes on, and so there's 5 of them come and grab me and pick me up. One of them cut off my tie, Pop Prince grabbed my shirt and was going to rip it off, and somebody grabbed a hold of my foot and tried to take my shoe off, and I already tightened up my foot and so forth, so he couldn't do it, and I heard something pop.
Ooh.
And that's when things stopped right there. Everybody, I had to pitch the whole series on that bad ankle, and in doing so, then that's what probably caused me the problem of ripping my, rotator cuff again, because I tried to make up this extra speed. Because all I could do is practically just fall off of the rubber. And I couldn't really push like enough. And so I would try to make that extra speed up by hand and arm speed. And in doing so, that's when I tore it. So maybe Murtaugh saw that, see it, what the way I was acting. And so anyway, that when they brought in Roy, Roy had done a good job up to that point, but he couldn't get anybody out, they got Yogi Berra steps up there and hits a 3-run homer off from him, and of course, 2 of those runs were charged to me.
Yeah.
But anyway, and I kid Mazeroski about this all the time. I said, Maz, you know something? If Murtaugh left me in, you wouldn't have the hit, because we had a 2-run lead going into the last half of the into our last half inning. You wouldn't even have the hit. But I'd got
so you helped
into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, you put him in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I'm happy for Maz because he had that opportunity and he capitalized on it. So. But again, crazy things happened in that series that helped us. Maybe the man upstairs had a lot to do with that too.
Is there any way that you could describe your feeling? Well, first of all, when Murtaugh pulled you from the game, did he ask you? How do you feel?
Murtaugh was a man of few words. When he come out, he had made up his mind, and I could tell when he come out there. I can tell by his demeanor and everything. I wasn't going to talk him out of this one. You know, back when I pitched an 18 inning game and we won it in the 19th inning, I was taken out. They wouldn't let me pitch any longer. But when the manager came out, I was able to talk to my manager back then. That it wasn't Murtaugh, but I talked to my manager back then. So let me stay in, Skip. I'm doing fine. I'm okay. You know, and he let me stay in. But Murtaugh wouldn't do that.
Was
he
that Fred?
He just said, Deacon, I'm going to make a change. I'm going to have Elroy come in. I said, well, if that's what you think's best, you know. Well, he says, yeah, I've made up my mind, you know. And so I didn't argue with him or anything. But I'll say one thing. Don Holt, come over. He was there listening to all this. And he says, Deacon, he says, listen, when you walk out of here, you hold your head up. Don't you look down. You hold your head up. You've done a heck of a job for us, you know.
Boy, I'll say.
And I really appreciated that. That kind of eased the pain a little bit.
Well, you pitched great that game, I thought. I wanted to ask, when Maz hit the home run, could you describe the feeling that overcame?
It was probably one of the most wonderful feelings you could have, because here, that's what every player that ever put on a major league uniform wants. They want to be part of a World Series championship team. And at that point, that's what we were. And everybody was just, they were thrilled, absolutely thrilled with it. And even the whole city. You know, we hadn't won anything since 1924 or 22?
27,
or
I think.
Anyway.
Yeah.
It was, they hadn't won anything, you know, in the professional sports. And now they call it the City of Champions, because after we opened it up, well, then pretty soon there was the Steelers, and then the Panthers. They started winning, and you know, and so it's kind of carried over after that once happens, you know. But it was like the Chicago Cubs. They went through a drought that just went on and on and on, you know, and yet they had great players and good people on their team, but it just didn't happen. But after finally they won to be in the World Series and so on, you know, then that made a difference for their city and for the fans, of course. Now you've got teams like the Nationals and Tampa Bay. Mm-hmm. They hadn't done much of anything, and they finally got into the playoffs and so forth. So, you know, it's good to see the game progress in those various cities, that help them win championships. The Astros, they were the same way until they broke loose. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just takes a few breaks and a few good players and good decisions by managers that's all you need to have a great year.
Oh, sure. That had to be the most incredible experience. The 60 Pirates are my time.
Yes.
They're my all-time favorite team, because they exemplified so much of, you know, never giving up and always seemed to be coming back and wouldn't take.
Exactly. Well, that's what happened to us. I can remember games when we were three runs down the ninth inning with, nobody on base, down three runs, and we end up winning, even with two strikes on the hitter, you know, and we bounced back. I think that year we had about 30 or somewhere right in the 30s where we won games from the seventh inning on. And like you say, that's happened this year as well for those teams that are playing. So it is amazing, you know, what happens, especially the second half of the season, you know, how they come together and really start winning. You know, that's what's happened to the Nationals. They didn't get off to a great start, you know, but they somehow turn it around, you know. They start getting a few breaks and people start believing great things happen when you keep on believing and keep on working.
Yeah, that's it. I want to back up a little bit. In 1950, you went to you it was a big year for you. That's when you got married, and I have here from my notes you got married to Vanita in Logan, Utah. And
right.
Yeah, and you were dating in high school. Now is she still with us, Vanita, your wife?
Well, you know, I went to high school with her. You know, that's where we the first met, of course, you know, and then we started dating, and then after we graduated, I signed a professional contract, and of course that kept us apart for a while, but then in 1950, that's the year that we got married, and we still love each other.
Oh, that's great.
We take care of each other. We've been married 69 years. And
oh, congratulations.
We'll be celebrating that this March.
Wow, that's awesome. But by the way, when you were talking about the series, it was 59 years and 2 days ago that happened, that game seven. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I guess every time October 13th comes around, you it's a memory then.
Yeah, we've had great memories together without question. You know, raising our family and then seeing them kids grow up and develop and be good gentlemen and men and having great success, you know, in their professions. And we are kind of struggling with one son right now who's got leukemia for the second time, and he's lost everything, you know, because of the first time his insurance kind of helped a great deal. And of course we had neighbors that would stop by and put on dinners, or there'd be a golf tournament that was played, and so we had a lot of help, and also from the major leagues, from BAT. BAT made a big difference because they paid they give the check of $15,000 to find a donor, and as it turned out, our daughter was a perfect match for him, and so that she gave said he had to have bone marrow transplant, and to see him go through what he went through that first time, it was just heartbreaking. Matter of fact, I'd go in and we'd go in practically every day and see him in the hospital, and you go in there and you can hardly recognize him, you know, because of steroids and face all puffed up, his hair gone, he's just a different looking person, you know. But after the transplant and everything, he got better and was able to go back to work and so forth, but that took his insurance away from him, it's heartbreaking to see that even now, even for the second time, they won't give him any disability, which is really something, because he's unable to work right now. There were times that I was with him when if he even drank water, he'd go throw it up, other times he was just so sick he couldn't get up, you know. It just was that bad, and yet he has been fighting. He's been fighting this and doing the best he can. He can put on a big front, but just last Sunday here, yesterday, we go out to our son's place where he's at, and he's in bed. He can't. He doesn't feel like eating, you know. And so again, you know, he's fighting it, but I don't know how much longer he can, because he's struggling with it. And like I say, he's lost everything. And so we need to. We've done and are still working to try to help him. You know, I get autographs from people that will send an extra $10 bill or whatever, you know, and so on, knowing that he's going through this. And so, but you know, there are a lot of good people in this world. You just, you know, we we're so divisive now, you know, and racist and whatever you want to call it, you know, it's so much corruption going on and so forth, and not just the government, but against each other. And that's not the way it's supposed to be, you know. There's a reason why the Savior came to this earth, and I think that we need to back off and start reading the scriptures and doing things and living the 12 commandments and living the Constitution, which we feel is authored and people inspired by the man upstairs, you know. And so there are so many things that is not going well in our country now, but we keep trying it, you know. Like here, and our church is we're the first ones whenever there's a disaster. We're always the first ones there with money, with food, with clothing, with whatever's needed. We have programs, you know, but we've got to come together as a nation if we're going to survive. Because if we start to keep doing what we're doing, I think somebody else is going to step in and stop it all. And so we need to be more loving and caring and compassionate towards our fellow men, you know, and stop all of what we're doing. But anyway, that's just my opinion. But the same way in baseball, you know, we have a lot of different cultures that are playing the game now in the United States, and they're great players. They really are great players and deserve opportunities, you know. But they're not getting it in their country, so they're coming to ours. And I know we've got a lot of good American ball players that not getting signed because of this. But that's neither here nor there, you know. But anyway, it does affect our lives, and we've got to be more understanding and kind towards those who maybe take our jobs or whatever. But sometimes it's very difficult for people to do that. But I know with our church, we take care of each other as well, not just members of the church. Like I say, we're the first ones there when there's ever a disaster, we're there to help, you know, that's the way it should be. That's the way it should be, and that's what we're supposed to do. You read the scriptures, you'll find out a lot of things that we should do and are not doing, you know. So, but anyway, that's my faith and belief, and I don't mean to preach on that, but necessary sometimes to understand even the game of baseball, and I see what's happening with the NBA, you know, people making and protesting, you know, and when they shouldn't be doing things that